When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Hey, what is up, everybody?
And welcome back to Mile High Podcast, episode 305. Now, today we are going to be looking at a case that many of you have requested. I've been seeing, I don't know if there's a spike in interest in it right now, but I saw comments requesting it on my show just yesterday when I was looking. And I'm really surprised that I've never heard of this one.
Same.
Up until we started looking
Same.
Into it.
I feel like it's probably crossed our desk a few times over the years because
yeah.
It's not a recent case by any means.
Mm-mm. 2006.
My God, it is probably one of the most baffling missing persons cases.
It really
we've
is.
Ever covered.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about Brian Schaefer, who really just vanished. I mean, there's not a whole lot to go off here. I mean, there's plenty of information to go over and lots of different theories. Some of them are pretty whack, I would say, but
it's one of those where the person's seemingly there 1 minute and then the next minute they're just virtually gone.
Yeah.
And there's no signs whatsoever of where he went or what happened after he disappeared. There's a few things that maybe lead one direction, but there's just really not that much. There's just kind of theories as to what happened to him, and is he still out there? This is one of those where he could be.
Yeah, he very well could be, I think. I kind of lean towards that way a little bit. I don't know. We'll get into all of that. But I think that's the reason why there is so much online speculation theories, because there isn't a lot to work with. There's not a lot confirmed. And there is a lot of misinformation out there as well. So I think that just leaves people trying to put together whatever they can to make sense of this, because it's just extremely confusing how this happened.
But you wanted to mention something briefly before we kind of jumped in today.
I did. Did I?
Yeah. NCMEC.
Oh, but before we jump into the case, I wanted to quickly take a moment to encourage you all to check out the items we have available for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children right now. We are in pretty low stock of a lot of the items, but this is the last restock of this whole collection. So if you want something, now is the time to get it. And you can feel good about your purchase, because 100% of the profit is donated directly to NCMEC. And they are super, super grateful for, you know, all of the purchases that we've had over the years. I think we are nearing $450,000 raised.
That's amazing.
Pretty close. Yeah. So if you'd like to help us reach our goals here, we would really appreciate that. They are available at kendallray.shop. And yes, we have one of my favorite items we have right now is the blue Topaz long sleeve. It's super comfortable. I love the color of it. We also have a few of the sweatshirts left as well. So check it out. That'll be linked below. And thank you in advance for your support. And before we get started, I always forget to say this, but I am your host, Kendall, joined by
Josh.
Thank you. And we are also joined by our two amazing producers, Janelle, and the newest addition to our show, Ian. And of course, Alice is here as well. Let's go ahead and get into this case. So I want to start by talking more about Brian Schaefer and who he is. He was born on February 25th, 1979, to his mother, Renee, and his father, Randy. He also has a younger brother named Derek, with whom Brian was very, very close with. Their family lived in Pickerington, Ohio, which is a small affluent suburb outside of Columbus. And Brian's mother was a nurse who always pushed him to explore the medical career as well. And Brian was very, very close with his mom. He really, truly adored her. He even wrote on his MySpace page, and I love this. He wrote, quote, "Doing things with my mom, who was the greatest, most wonderful person in the world." And he also listed her as his only hero, which I just thought was so sweet. And their family loved Brian too. He was charming, athletic, and always did well in school. He also was very athletic. He played baseball and was tennis captain for the Pickerington High School team. He had a high school sweetheart as well, an unnamed woman that he would continue to see throughout the years. His brother Derek also had a girlfriend, a young girl named Marin, who he would eventually marry. Now, the Schaefers were really living the classic American dream. I mean, successful parents, well-liked, academic kids, and they had a big house with a big yard. However, as graduation neared for Brian in 1997, he wondered what he wanted to do with his life. His girlfriend had moved to California for school, and he planned to go to the Ohio State University's Lancaster campus to study business and technology. But Brian's true passion, above all else, was music. He had a band in high school and always wanted to live like Jimmy Buffett. He really idolized Jimmy Buffett. He wanted to, you know, live that beach bum life with a guitar and a margarita. And who doesn't want to live that life, right?
Sounds amazing.
It sure does.
I think we all do to some extent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And even though Brian's parents were supportive, they wanted him to have a real career before finding an island to spend the rest of his days at. His mother really pushed him into med school, but he spent his first year trying to get a business degree and make his own way. But after 1 year of studying business at the Lancaster campus, he transferred to OSU's main campus in Columbus, Ohio. And while he did well academically, he didn't really see the point of getting a business degree. So thinking practically, he ended up switching his major to microbiology and minored in molecular genetics. So very, very smart. He also joined the Alpha Epsilon Delta Health Professionals Club and the Microbiology Club. In 2003, Brian got his bachelor's degree and stayed at OSU to complete a 4-year med school program. And Renee, his mom, was very proud of Brian, and he continued to be a bright, successful student. In 2005, he was actually in the top 10 of his class, so very, very impressive. And it was also in 2005 that Brian started dating Alexis Wagner, another second-year med student who loved Brian. And his family loved her, too. She really fit in well with them. And for Christmas of 2005, Renee actually gifted Brian and Alexis a trip to Miami for the upcoming spring break. And obviously, they were super stoked for that very generous gift. So once again, it seemed like Brian really had it all. I mean, he had a beautiful girlfriend, a successful academic career that looked like it would turn into a successful professional career, and he had a family who really had his back. But still, Brian could not shake his first passion in life, which was music. He even had a Pearl Jam tattoo on his right arm, definitely one of his favorite bands, and he continued to post on MySpace about his dream to play music on the beach. Here's another quote from him. It says, "I really love music, and this whole doctor thing is really just a job, only temporary, in parentheses, until I get my band together and put out a record. I want to own an island someday, or at least a beach, at least, so I can listen to Buffett all day and drink margaritas with my senorita." And I think this is really interesting considering what ends up happening. It's hard to tell how serious he was about this. I mean, was he really saying, I want to own my own island one day, or at least a beach? And he really wanted that. I mean, that's a big dream, right? To own your own island or beach. Or was it just kind of a casual thing to say? I mean, it's MySpace. How seriously can you take it? But
yeah, that's what I was saying. I mean, I said a lot of wild things on MySpace. So
I certainly did too.
So. I kind of like getting to go down this memory lane a little bit of the MySpace days. And just, I mean, in MySpace, was really centered around music,
yeah,
and kind of like showcasing your, you know, your musical interests while also being this social media platform.
Yeah, it's really the elite social media platform.
I miss it. I miss
it,
honestly.
I think we can all agree it's time to bring back MySpace.
And like all the customization you could do on it was so sick. Like,
I'd spend so much time, like HTML. Fonts. I was like coding my layout.
That was great.
5 hours on a Friday night.
Yeah, you could put so much time into it. Your top friends and music playlists that would. You could like set the song that's going to like play on your profile as soon as people went to it. It was always interesting to go to people's profiles and hear their different musical tastes.
And I feel like everyone's top visitor to their MySpace page was themselves. I was always on page,
for sure.
Admiring
just
my
refreshing
work.
After you make a change.
Like, remember how they had those like third party sites where you copy paste code?
The layout.
It was supposed to make it do something.
Yeah.
So I'd copy paste, refresh, and it like wouldn't work. I'd be like, damn it, what am I doing? Something's wrong.
The code, go through the whole thing, like look for a slash or something. Yes. Yeah. Those were the days.
I was going to say, I didn't get to go on MySpace. What? I was too young. I'm sorry. My sister was on, though, and I was always so jealous. I was like, God, I know I'm like 6 years old, but let me get on.
I want a MySpace.
Yeah. I need a MySpace.
I want to talk about the Wiggles, dude. Like, what's the problem?
That's, you have like the Wiggles song as your intro. Oh, yeah, that's crazy. It was
such a vibe. MySpace was.
But yeah, it was when we were in middle school, because it was pretty much done by the time
by
we
high school,
school
it was Facebook.
Yeah, Facebook was so lame compared to it.
Yeah, all the customization was not there.
No. Nope.
But as far as this statement, I think if you look at the period of life that he's in, this to me seems very kind of like lighthearted and just kind of like something he'd say to his friends, you know what I mean? Like, I really love music. This whole doctor thing is just temporary. He clearly is acknowledging that I need to make money to support myself.
And it's almost to say this whole doctor thing kind of seems joking too. Like, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I think
the big thing to pursue is just a temporary thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's such a commitment to become a doctor. Yeah. I think some people might be like, well, is it kind of hinting at his, you know, he's kind of been pushed into this career field a little bit, and maybe there's, because, you know, you always hear about that, not with everybody, obviously, but some people who especially come from a family of medical professionals are like, yeah, my dad, my mom's a doctor, and they're encouraging me to do it. And there's definitely some pressure there, and it depends on who it is, on the actual level of pressure,
right?
To have their son or daughter follow them in their footsteps. But there's,
and we know he was encouraged for sure,
right?
Was he forced and I don't know the extent of it, but it definitely was encouraged. Yeah. But I think this statement, you could take it two different ways. I mean, he could have been completely serious. You know, he really had a dream of owning an island and wanted to go live that life. Which is interesting to think about for later on.
Yeah, I honestly do think he was pretty serious about it. I think for his like college career, he was always just thinking practically. Like, he was like, okay, I'm going to be a business major at first so I can make a bunch of money and then buy the island. And then, you know, at a certain point, you kind of realize like, oh, there's not a guaranteed career that way.
Right.
But like, he had seen his parents and how well off they were after medical professions. So he was like, well, and luckily, he's incredibly smart, so he could pick really anything, and that would work out for him. So I think it really was like, this is only temporary. I'm just going to make a bunch of money and then go live on a beach somewhere.
Retire early.
I lean that way, too.
And pursue his real passion, making music on the beach. Brian was very focused on medical school. He had lived with his close friend, Clint Florence, who we'll talk about quite a bit in this episode, earlier in the year, but moved out before the lease was up for unknown reasons. I would really love to know if there's more to that than it was just kind of like the arrangement wasn't working out or something. Right. Like, was there more beef going on that kind of led to this situation? Brian ended up living alone in 2006, and at that point, he was really focused on his studies as well as his girlfriend, Alexis. And according to his family, he planned to propose to Alexis during spring break on that trip to Miami. He had asked his mom about jewelry stores and how much he should spend on a ring. They'd only been together for 1 year, but still the two meant everything to each other. I think they really started realizing like, hey, this might be it. You might be the one. Alexis posted on his MySpace page, quote, "You are one gorgeous man. And happy Valentine's Day, Brian. I love you, and I can't wait to see you later today." Clint also posted on Brian's MySpace a month later saying, quote, "Ladies, don't believe a word this man says. He loves the ass tags."
Ass tags.
I think I know what this is.
Do you?
Yeah, this was like hashtag ass.
Oh, you're probably right. But were there hashtags back then?
Yeah.
There were hashtags on MySpace?
There were.
I don't remember that. I remember hashtags coming about like Twitter and Instagram.
I vaguely remember.
Or no, maybe you're right.
Yeah.
Like being able to click on the tag.
Yeah, you could click on the tags and then you would see like pictures that have hashtag ass. And I sound like I know this from personal experience. Because I do. I was a teenager. All right. Give me a break.
All right. But we'll take your word for it then.
I'm just speculating, but I think that's what that means, is that his friend Clint knew that he was looking at butts online, essentially.
According to Urban Dictionary,
Janelle's already on it.
It says, played with boys and girls when you are quote unquote it to tag someone, you come up behind them and give them a smack on the bum.
Huh. Oh, so maybe it wasn't anything to do with actual tags.
But like,
yeah, but that's like using it as slang.
But like, who's in college playing hiding like tag?
Well, why would he put that on his MySpace? I think he was insinuating his usage online with that. But again, we don't know for sure.
I also thought it could mean like a lower back tattoo, like a tramp stamp.
Oh, maybe you're right.
Another potential. But now that you say that, I am like, hey, he probably was looking at butts online.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably the best guess.
Yeah.
God, so random. I didn't know Justin Timberlake owns MySpace, part of it.
Yeah.
What is he doing with it? Nothing?
No, no. He jointly purchased the company for $35 million. So random.
We still
just
own
happen
that?
To see it. Yeah, I guess so.
So, and also, I'm kind of saying that based on more information that Clint kind of provides later on in this story. But throughout this whole ordeal, Clint was definitely painting Brian in a different way than I think Brian was trying to be perceived by people and be perceived by his girlfriend and stuff like that.
In the way that his family sees him or wants him to be perceived.
Right, exactly. So while everyone maintained that Brian was serious about Alexis, Clint hinted that maybe Brian had a wandering eye. However, as midterms came around, the Schaefer family suffered their first tragedy. On March 6, 2006, Renee passed away from myelodysplasia, which is a rare form of cancer, and her death absolutely rocked the family. It was very shocking. And while they all lived close together, the upcoming final exams kept Brian away from Derek and his father. Derek was also attending Ohio State University and living with his girlfriend, Warren. While Brian focused on his studies, he acted erratically in other ways. His father, Randy, gave him a check for $4,500 to pay for the following semester. However, he never deposited that money. He also acted strangely towards Alexis as well. He asked her to run away with him to leave everything behind, and when she said no, Brian told her she would leave him because he didn't know when he would get better. She refused to leave him and tried to stay by his side throughout all the grief he was experiencing. So that's another that's
a crucial piece to
that's know. A very interesting story from her as to this conversation of him being like, let's get up and leave together.
Yeah.
And maybe that was behind. Just metaphorically, like, because of everything that was going on. His mother just passed, and it's just kind of like he needed to get away.
Yeah.
But, yeah, something to keep in mind. While Brian and Alexis stayed together, he actually had run away before. In his first year of med school, he randomly took a trip to the Caribbean without telling anyone. While this fed speculation once Brian disappeared, the difference is that he did tell his family where he was once he landed. But Brian stayed at OSU and pulled multiple all-nighters to complete his final exams. And he did really well, scoring at least an 86 on one of his tests. Considering the grief and all the things he was going through at the time, this was extremely impressive. So it seems like despite everything going on, he was still able to focus on school and, you know, get really good grades. Friday, March 31st, 2006, though, was the last day of classes before spring break. And Brian planned to celebrate by doing a bar crawl with Clint. And this would be the last time anyone saw Brian again. So Brian had originally had plans to go out earlier in the night, but pushed them back to have dinner with his dad, Randy, who had been dealing with the grief basically all alone. Yes, he had his sons, but they were focused on school for most of the month, and Renee had been his whole world, and Randy has been quoted as saying, "She was my soulmate, my partner in everything I did. To lose her was just a shock to my life."
That is so heartbreaking.
Brian felt it was important to spend time with his father before he headed to Florida for most of spring break, so he ended up meeting Randy at the Outback Steakhouse in Reynoldsburg around 6 p.m. And on the way, Brian called his brother Derek to see if he could make it to dinner. Derek didn't end up coming to dinner because he had a prior event he was going to with his girlfriend. They had tickets to a comedy show, but he did say that he would try to meet up for drinks later. The Outback was Randy and Renee's favorite restaurant, and Randy ordered a meal they often shared together, which brought back memories of his late wife, and Randy started to cry. And Brian told him, quote, "It's all right, Dad. I'll be with you as much as I can." Randy said that Brian didn't seem depressed while at dinner. He did note that he seemed exhausted from the exams and was, quote, "anxious to go out that night." Anxious.
Yeah, we're not really sure what he meant by that Was he, did he seem nervous to go out, or was he just really looking forward to it and wanted to get through dinner so he could go out? I don't know. I mean, there is no answer to that.
Yeah. And it could just be his vocabulary too. You know, we don't know how he talks, you know, normally. So it could just be something completely normal for him to say. But of course, people are like, could that be a sign, or is that, you know,
I take it foreshadowing like what's about to happen? He was looking forward to going out, especially because he had been going through these exams and he was...
Yeah, let loose, you know, blow some steam off.
Right.
You know, just try to relax.
Yeah.
Before they finished having dinner, Brian did set up a plan with his dad to go over to the family house the following day to help clean up, as they still had boxes of Renee's old stuff, and understandably, it was hard for Randy to pack all of this away. Meanwhile, Brian's girlfriend Alexis had gone home to Toledo to visit her family before their trip to Miami. She and Brian had called earlier in the day, and he told her he was going out that night with the guys to talk about her. After Derek and Marin left the comedy show, they called Brian to tell them that, you know, they couldn't have drinks that night. They were just too tired after the exams, and they just wanted to go home and catch up on sleep.
So around 9:30 p.m. that night, Clint met Brian over at his apartment, and they started pre-gaming. Then they made the 10-minute walk to the South Campus Gateway. Now, the Gateway was a project between OSU and the city of Columbus to gentrify the area. The town off campus was known for high crime rates, and the Gateway project was built to have a spot, you know, a safer spot for students off of campus. And the structure had a movie theater, university bookstores, restaurants, a parking garage, and the infamous college bar, the Ugly Tuna Saluna. Kind of fun to say. But the Ugly Tuna was definitely a well-known bar that catered to students. And reading Yelp reviews and college newspaper articles about it definitely gives you a picture of the type of bar it was. The bouncers were known for letting in groups of underage students, but they would always turn one away, so the rest of their friends would have to decide if they should abandon their friends or leave with them. On top of that, it also had a very dangerous happy hour deal. It's crazy. You could never find this nowadays, which is probably a good thing, but it was $1 for well alcohol mixed drinks, combined with a $10 card minimum. So clearly, it's a easy place to get drunk.
Yeah, they'd actually call it the Ugly Hour. How good could $1 mixed drinks be?
Dude, they do that at Applebee's, don't they?
You be hitting up the Applebee's?
They don't do that at Applebee's.
Wait, $1
There's no way they're letting people come do $1
mixed drinks. In 2024?
Applebee's is a family restaurant, Janelle.
Excuse me. $1 margs are back for a limited time at Applebee's. Thank you very much.
Dollarita is here.
Yeah, but it's like...
toxic.
Maximum limit two. I guarantee you they're not going to let you down 10 Dollaritas at Applebee's.
I can confirm they will not let you do that.
Have you tried it?
I was going to say, has anybody ever seen someone completely sloshed at an Applebee's
or
Chili's?
I'm
sure people have.
John and I often joke we're going to black out at the bees.
Black out at the bees.
I want you to try to do that.
It's a challenge.
All right, you do that. Film it.
Well, not if they're only giving me two.
Okay, so it does still exist nowadays. But yeah, so 10...
But if there's no limit and you have an hour to drink dollar mixed drinks, you can bet your ass.
At least 10 of them for the $10 card minimum, unless you're buying for someone else too.
Well, or order like shots or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, true.
Food.
True. But yeah, easy way to get drunk.
Some of the Yelp reviews for this place describe the Ugly Hour drinks as tasting like battery acid. Like, you'd get a mixed drink and it was like a pina colada would be a giant shot with a splash of coconut like water. Or
that's kind of fun. Or you know what it is?
Kind of fun.
You know, like on bars and they have the like rubber mats when they like make the drinks on it.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, there's tons of liquor on it. People always joke like they take the mats and just like
dump it
into a glass. That's your mixed drink.
Oh, I'm sure that happens some places.
It's just like a mixture of a bunch of random alcohols.
Like Skull vodka.
I wonder if they even give you like a lime or like a garnish on it at all.
Probably not.
No, it's probably
like a little plastic cup.
Probably.
Yeah. But anyway, the Ugly Tuna was on the second floor of the Gateway complex. And what's important to note is that despite the bar's reputation, it was well monitored.
Because people be getting rowdy at the Ugly Tuna, man.
Yep.
So I'm sure they've had their fair share of crazy nights, fights.
Mm-hmm.
So they got to have Got to have security there.
Which they still have. There's a Ugly Tuna
2.
The
Ugly Tuna 2.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So you can still go.
I like
if you
Ugly
want.
Tuna Saluna better.
Yeah, that's Saluna. Way that's way catchier. That's mm-hmm, very good. But anyway, you had to take an escalator to reach the only entrance to the Ugly Tuna, and the Columbus police officers guarded the service exits and all the other doors. So most of the public area of the Gateway Complex was monitored by CCTV as well. So,
which
yeah,
I
still...
will say, CCTV in 2006, as you'll see, we'll show you a clip here in a little bit.
Yeah, it's pretty
rough. I think that's a big thing worth mentioning is that camera technology, I mean, still in 2024, sometimes we watch surveillance footage like, what the hell is this? Is this camera not been updated for 20 years? But in 2006, we're talking very grainy, low res cameras.
At least it was working.
True.
Half the cases we cover, the cameras just don't work and haven't in a long time.
True. Or they're just like, oh, they don't record.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, so what are they there for?
But the Gateway Complex was new, so there was construction going on as well. And students who attended OSU at the same time as Brian described sneaking through construction areas to gain unmonitored access to service doors and wandered throughout the complex. And even though the construction areas have been described as dangerous online, they really weren't that bad, it doesn't seem. They were all indoors, and while the ground was certainly uneven, they were nearing the completion of these areas the night that Brian and Clint made their way to the Ugly Tuna. Before entering the bar, Brian made one last phone call to Alexis around 9:56 p.m., and he told her that he couldn't wait for their Monday trip to Miami, and he said that he loved her. And then Clint and Brian entered the Ugly Tuna and met up with a group of med students who planned to do the same thing. Stop at every bar on a crawl downtown, have a shot at each one, you know, the huge. And Clint and Brian were definitely close friends and drinking buddies, but like we alluded to earlier, it seems like there was tension between them. It's hard to know exactly what was going on. We know that there was something off, but there's not any details about exactly what they were struggling with. But the last time they went out together, they fought again for an unknown reason. And this was on St. Patrick's Day. Now, we'll go over that a little bit more later, but this was the first night that the two of them had
gone out together.
Yeah, yeah. Since that fight.
Maybe a little awkward. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, we have no idea.
And we don't know what their beef was exactly.
No.
But it also could have been, I feel like a lot of people who are really close with someone, you know, if you have like a little fight here and there, I think a lot of time also with men, like they just kind of like, you know, and then like get over it and it's like whatever, especially if it's somewhat common, which we don't know if it was, but it wouldn't really surprise me if it was because of the fact that Clint had moved out prior.
I don't know. After you throw hands.
No, I don't know.
I don't know, man. We're not friends anymore if we're throwing hands.
But we don't know that that happened.
Yeah, they fought.
It's alleged to be like a physical altercation. Yeah.
But like, could you?
I just thought they were arguing.
But were they like really trying to injure each other? Were they both just like kind of being drunk idiots and like, we're like, fuck you, man, like pushing your shirt? I don't know, you know?
Yeah, I guess we have no idea. Oh, that's interesting.
Well, if they hadn't hung out since, I would speculate that it was more angry than it was just like, oh, we're just drunk.
And then obviously moving out. Like,
if you're just having like a drunken fight with your friend, you're going to get over that probably pretty quickly because you'll both realize like, oh, that was. So to me, it kind of seems like there was something that they were fighting over that they really disagreed on, or they were mad at each other for some reason. And then they took some time, you know, and also such a big thing as moving out before the lease is up. You know what I mean? There's big decisions being made amongst these two. And that's what makes me believe there's something bigger that they were fighting over than just it being this like a casual brawl between two friends. You know what I mean?
But at the end of the day, we have no idea. That's what's so tough on this case is that's pure speculation. We just don't know. I mean,
which
I
is
agree
not
with you that it's
to not know.
No, it's definitely not helpful.
Because what if we're totally wrong and it's like, oh, he moved out because the rent was too expensive or something?
And that's why I want to really clarify that is I don't want people already getting like too set in one way about Clint when we just don't know the details. But anyway, back to the timeline here. They ended up not staying at the Ugly Tuna that long. They had their first shot there and then they kept it moving. And then they arrived at the Short North Tavern around 10:30 p.m., which was a little over a mile further down. They got their shot there and then walked another half a mile further to Brothers Bar and Grill, where they met up with more friends, and they stayed there most of the night. Meredith Reed, who is one of Clint's close friends, also met up with them there, and most reports list Meredith as Clint's friend, but they seem to be a little more than that, possibly. Again, that's kind of speculating, but they did spend nights together at each other's homes frequently, and they were always seen together from, you know, several different reports. Meredith was even there on the night that Clint and Brian fought and was potentially the one who helped them reconcile. But again, not sure on that. And then the three of them broke off from the group and they drove back to the Ugly Tuna. Around 1:15 a.m., they were seen on CCTV coming up the escalator and entering the Ugly Tuna.
At least two security cameras were inside the Ugly Tuna, and one was focused on the bar area and the other panned to the far side where the emergency exit was. If that exit was opened, an alarm would sound and then the camera would pan over towards that door. That was the way that it was programmed. However, this footage has never been publicly released. One other service exit in the Ugly Tuna didn't have a camera focused on it, and this exit would lead straight to the construction site on the ground level. We can see that Brian started talking to two young women, Amber Ruick and Brighton Zatko. And they were both students in a class that Clint TA'd, and Brian enjoyed speaking to them. This is another part of the story we'll cover later on, but Clint described it as, quote, "Brian was doing his usual thing and was talking to those two girls." Kind of vague, but also kind of gives you a little bit more insight, perhaps.
Well, insight from Clint's perspective.
Right. Brian also really liked the band playing at the Ugly Tuna that night. He wanted to see if there was an after party or if he could host one after the bar closed. At 1:55 a.m., Brian is seen on the security cam footage for the last time. He was outside the bar next to the escalators talking to Amber and Brighton. The girl said that he didn't seem too drunk, but he was definitely flirtatious. He offered to walk them to their car and even gave them his phone number. And there's a weird moment where he appears to slip something into their purses, but this is unconfirmed. The girls then leave and Brian goes back into the bar. But we want to show you a little clip of that specific part in the security footage. Let's take a look.
Also, there's no sound.
Yeah. So we'll try to explain it as best as we can for you from what we can make out.
Can't make out a whole lot.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I don't even know how to describe.
So that's Brian in the darker colored shirt.
It's like literally just a couple seconds of him standing
outside.
Yeah,
with the two girls. He goes into his pocket, it looks like.
Yeah, I don't see.
Oh, then see that arm right there? He goes like this, just out of view. He definitely like gives one of them something. He goes in his pocket and then he.
I wouldn't say definitely. No, I don't know.
What if he just grabbed someone?
Yeah, or.
But the way, just watch it though.
Reaching for something.
No, it looks like he put his arm around him, around her.
Could be.
Yeah, I don't see the putting something in the purse.
Watch his hand first. It goes down. It looks like it goes down into his pocket. Maybe he was just holding it there and then he just like, yeah.
Yeah, it's too hard to tell.
It is really. That's why I didn't feel confident in being like, oh, he definitely. Because there are some people who are like, he absolutely slipped something in there.
No, you can't say that from
you
this.
You definitely
clip.
Can't. But you can see like there he looks at the cop and then he tries to like put some. But he also could just be drunk and tries to like make a move or something, you know?
Yeah.
Or maybe they made like a funny joke and he was like, oh, you know.
Yeah.
Or it could have been something totally as innocent as something fell out of the purse and he put it in there. I don't know. I mean, I feel like reading too much into that isn't helpful. And if they found anything of importance, that would have been, you know, reported to law enforcement.
Maybe, unless they didn't report it.
That's true.
The girls
you
may
would hope they would.
Maybe it was an illegal substance or something that he was giving them and they're not going to report
be.
That.
It's a weird place to do that exchange. And without them facing, like, why would you? I don't know. I don't see it.
So after this, he goes back inside and speaks to Meredith and Clint again. Clint and Brian might have gotten into another fight, though this is unconfirmed. And after this brief conversation, Brian said he was going to go talk to the band and walked away. So it's very, very late at night. It's like, you know, very close to the bar shutting down because at around 2 a.m., the bar had its last call. Clint and Meredith looked around the bar and checked the restroom, and they're seen on camera by the escalators trying to call Brian's phone. At this point, his phone went straight to voicemail, and Meredith left a message that said, quote, Where the Hell Are You? The band had already left through the unmonitored exit with a large group in tow. During previous nights out, Brian had disappeared without telling anyone, so Clint and Meredith assumed that he had just left, his phone had died, and he'd be back at his apartment. Clint and Meredith then returned to a professor's house he was watching and went to sleep. The next day is also murky, as we only have public statements from Meredith, but she remembered that they had called Brian once again in the morning, and when they didn't get a response, they drove over to Brian's apartment. When they saw his car was still parked there, they assumed that he had just crashed with someone else or he was sleeping off the hangover and left. Meredith went home and then either worked out at the gym or a park near the Olentangy River. And then Clint came over at night and the two watched a movie before he went back to the professor's house. Brian's father, Randy, was also pretty unworried at this point. He had expected Brian to come over and help him clean the house. But again, Brian was known not to show up and just do his own thing. And even though his phone seemed to be off, he just assumed that Brian was nursing a hangover. Meanwhile, Alexis started to get pretty concerned, though. She had spoken to Clint Meredith, who explained what had happened to him. Since she was still in Toledo visiting family, she tried calling Brian constantly with no ring. And on Sunday, she returned home and went straight to Brian's apartment, where she saw that nothing was out of place. His books, his car, his glasses were exactly where he had left them after his exams.
So Alexis ends up calling Randy and explains the strange situation going on. And Randy had Derek drive to the apartment too, and he confirmed Alexis's suspicions. Brian was missing. Randy, Derek, and Alexis filed a missing persons report that night. And even though it had already been nearly 2 days since Brian was last seen, the police surprisingly, well, I guess I shouldn't say surprisingly, they didn't act fast. They assumed the same thing that everyone else did. Brian got drunk, wandered off somewhere, and didn't charge his phone. But once Brian missed his flight on Monday morning to Miami with Alexis, police knew that something was wrong. I think that's when everyone in his life knew something was wrong. So they pushed the story out to the media and began a widespread investigation across Columbus. Throughout the next 6 months, hundreds of tips would roll in constantly about Brian, and the national news descended onto Columbus to spread awareness about his disappearance. However, every new tip only brought in new questions. On April 10th, investigators received a tip that someone had spotted Brian at a convenience store near where he disappeared. However, after police reviewed the CCTV footage, they determined it unfortunately wasn't him. And police have not actually released this footage. We weren't able to see it ourselves, but if the security footage was low quality as the footage from Gateway, how conclusively could they say that it wasn't him? I mean, they may have their methods, but yeah, people have definitely questioned that. Brian's bank and credit card activity completely stopped after he was missing. That $4,500 tuition check from his father was never deposited. And this is partly because Randy did end up closing all of Brian's accounts after he was reported missing. Then on May 11th, 2006, an unknown person broke into Brian's apartment. And while police determined that there was no connection to his disappearance, as a few other homes in the area had been robbed as well, what's strange is that they only took a few DVDs and nothing else. Which is, yeah.
Think that's suspicious at all?
I don't know. I mean, I personally don't think it's that suspicious, considering the fact that, like, this case was huge. Like, at this point, it was all over the media, so I think someone just might have figured out, like, seen a news report or, like, read it in the paper and figured out where he lived and was like, okay, I'll break in. What's weird is that they only stole DVDs, but yeah. Again, he didn't really have much that would be of worth, you know, like maybe an entertainment system and textbooks. But mm-hmm. aside from that, you know, it's not like they could go and, like, steal his safe, you know.
Right.
He didn't have much.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't really think of it that way. They absolutely could have saw it as an opportunity, you know, clearly.
Well,
he's
especially
not there.
Since a few other homes.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was just complete coincidence that yeah. his happened to get hit.
Well,
as
and like DVDs. Maybe just realize that nobody's gone in or out for, you know, maybe if they're casing and feel like nobody's home, nobody's mm-hmm. going in and out of this place would be an easy spot to hit.
Yeah, that's true too.
But maybe whoever had something to do with his disappearance went back into his place, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know for sure.
It is possible that and the robbery it's just of his apartment had nothing to do with the others.
The other robberies, yeah. Right, exactly. So I think as much as you could go one way, I think the other way is also possible.
Yeah.
But again, what would they have been looking for? why only take a couple DVDs? What's the purpose behind that? Mm-hmm. Or did he go back into his place and take a few things and leave everything else? That's possible as well.
That's interesting. I hadn't even thought of that.
When we get into the theories, like, I'll make mm-hmm. my opinions more known on that. But if he was still alive and like purposefully disappeared, I mean, it would totally make sense to just be like, well, I can show up at my apartment. I'm really missing my copy of The Nutty Professor and then just like
yeah.
pick it up and leave. That kind of makes sense. It does.
Or there was something else that was taken out of the apartment that we're just not aware of. And it's possible that whether it was him or someone else that they took something, you know, that people didn't know was in there or, you know.
Whatever. Yeah, well, that's the big question is what exactly was taken. It's not like there was an inventory of everything in his apartment. So how do we know there was stuff in there that was taken that is actually critical to his disappearance?
Probably loved one's best guess of what was in there, but yeah.
Yeah, well, like DVDs, what comes to mind to me is like maybe there was something, you know, some type of family home video collection or something around his mother. Possibly memorial, you know, something like that, something like a keepsake that if it was Brian, he went back to get before leaving for good.
God, I really didn't even think about that. Really could have been him.
Right.
Well, and it's important to note, like, police never treated his apartment as a crime scene. So like you said, like, there was never an inventory that was taken.
They just kind of chalked it up to like, oh, well, these other homes in the area, which doesn't seem like the next door spot was robbed, but just in the general area. So to just chalk that up to like, oh, it must be the same burglar that's breaking into all these places, I think is almost a bit of a stretch. So to me, it seems a little more likely that it was either Brian or somebody involved with his disappearance that potentially went back into his place, or they took him back there or something along those lines.
If it really was Brian, it makes me think that there was something in there he needed that people are not aware of being in there. And then maybe he just grabbed some DVDs as well.
Yeah, or maybe he just had like a stash of money or something that he needed in order to fall through with his plan of his, if that's what his plan was.
Big if, but yeah.
Right, big if for sure, but just something to think about.
But anyway, OSU and Crime Stoppers offered a $7,000 reward for information on Brian Schaefer's whereabouts, and they had cadaver dogs sniff every inch of the Gateway complex, and one dog even found a trail leading to a nearby Wendy's parking lot, oddly
enough.
Which,
this to me is interesting because if you think about the what happened, if he did leave, is it possible that if Brian did leave on his own accord, did he just go to Wendy's to get some food after a night out drinking?
Yeah.
Or is it possible the dogs just got the scent of Wendy's and went to Wendy's? You know what I mean? Like, got the scent. Yeah, I'm just saying these dogs are great, but they also are not, it's not foolproof. Like, they can pick up on scents sometimes. It's like, of course it's Wendy's, a place of food. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Were the dogs really tracking his scent, or were they tracking something else? Or maybe he did go there.
Well, I don't know if this information was available, Ian, but do you know if they checked surveillance at Wendy's?
They did. Like you were saying before, the Wendy's surveillance worked, but it was like, it was only of the drive-thru, so they really didn't have a clear picture of the parking lot. But it's important to note that the trail, like, stopped at Wendy's. So that's to your point, Josh. Like, they really could have just smelled Wendy's and gone there.
Yeah, it's not totally ridiculous to say that.
Because like, it totally, like, that's where it ended. They could not go any further than that.
Or he got in someone's vehicle and left.
Right. That's the other option.
Or something happened to him at the Wendy's late at night, which shit pops off at fast food places all the time late at night. So I don't know. You never know who's hanging out.
They also searched the Olentangy River for Brian's body. And while it's unlikely if Brian had walked an extra 0.6 miles after leaving the Ugly Tuna, he would have been by water. But unfortunately, the search for Brian didn't start until 3 days after he went missing, like we said. And in that time, dumpsters could have been emptied and evidence erased. Brian,
super unfortunate that they didn't start searching for 3 days.
Yeah.
I mean, that is 72 hours.
Really frustrating.
A lot can happen in 72 hours.
Yep.
And I really wonder if this case would be different had they jumped, you know, had this been reported and jumped on literally the next morning. You know what I mean?
That, oh, yeah, probably would be different, I would say.
I mean, everybody's heard 48 hours, you know, for missing people.
It's, and like, it's true.
Critical to finding them. And so the more time that goes by, especially in these circumstances, the harder it gets to trace them, especially when there's no evidence.
And by this point, the police are totally confused by Brian's exit from the bar, because they knew that Brian didn't exit from the escalator and he couldn't have left from the emergency exit without sounding the alarm. And while Ugly Tuna was helpful in the investigation, they certainly didn't want police to know about their methods. You could say, you know, that students were served underage, and yeah, they probably didn't want people, the police, to know that they let people exit through the service door that led to a relatively dangerous construction zone.
Yeah, some serious violations here that would involve getting their liquor license revoked if they do find that they're serving underage kids alcohol. So
yep.
So you can, I think you can kind of like be like, they probably just gave them as much as they asked for, and likely weren't like divulging everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah. They also interviewed Alexis, Clint, and Meredith, and also those two girls that Brian talked to that night. And in the beginning, Clint was very public about the investigation. However, in May of 2006, he said, quote, "I am afraid Brian may have left the bar and ran his mouth a little bit. He has been known to do that." Now, his father, Randy, has disputed this claim and the claim about Brian frequently flirting with other women. Derek and Randy started to turn their suspicions toward Clint at that point, when I think they sort of felt he was, you know, not only like tarnishing his name, but also trying to set up other scenarios of what could have happened.
Yeah, well, he's kind of blaming Brian
for
what's happened.
But it's like, you have to, you can see it that way, but he could also just be trying to offer up his take of it all. He's a very close friend.
Right, he could just be giving an honest take on Brian that people don't want to hear.
Especially his family may not even know that side of him, if that's really how he was. But I could see how they could take it completely the other way and think he's like sort of setting up.
Totally.
You know, so it's just, again, we don't know. It really depends on how you see
it. Well, not only that, but he literally went out with Clint. Like, dude, you were with him last.
Yeah.
So you're going to know more than anybody else.
Right.
And now you're just kind of, you know, like you said, just making these things up and saying, oh yeah, you know, he probably ran his mouth too much or something, you know. But so they're clearly not believing these things that Clint is saying.
But he could have been telling the truth. Maybe he had seen him many other times get into fights, and I mean, who knows? So yeah, it's just really hard to say. But in response to that, you know, suspicion coming from their family, Clint and Meredith retained lawyers and refused to speak with the media or police after their initial interviews. And also, Clint refused to take a polygraph test, which definitely doesn't mean guilty. It's going to, you know, make people
suspicious. Well, the police are going to be like, that's fishy that he won't do it. And a lot of people are going to say that's suspicious he won't do it. If he doesn't have anything to hide, why not take the test?
But oftentimes lawyers are going to tell you, don't,
right.
Do not do that.
They're unreliable.
Yeah.
Not admissible in court.
And refusing to speak to the media and getting a lawyer definitely does not mean you are guilty. You know?
Innocent until proven guilty in the court of law.
There's a lot of speculation and stuff coming from people on Reddit and just like other discussion posts. There's lots of talk online about how Clint moved to Tennessee in the same month after this was all happening. And that's, as far as we can tell, not true. Actually, according to his LinkedIn, he finished med school at OSU in 2007 and then moved to Tennessee. And that was for reasons of like finishing some like program.
Residency.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I personally don't really think him moving has any significance. But at first, when I was reading discussion boards, I was messaging Ian like, yo, did he move to Tennessee right after that? But I don't actually think that has any connection to the case. Just wanted to put that out there, because I think we might get comments about it.
Yeah, that's a good thing to note in general, guys. There is a lot, I said this earlier, but there's a lot of misinformation out there on this case and a lot of theorizing. I mean, the Reddit is wild on this one.
It's very active, which
it's good.
Yeah, but also like can be damaging.
Double-edged sword.
Yeah, I get why. I mean, it's we're all just baffled by this. We're like, what could have happened?
Yeah. But just be careful with what you read, unless it's coming from a verified source, you know? So his father, Randy, remained really active in the investigation and even started raising awareness for other missing people throughout Ohio, which is so amazing. I mean, and you're that one of the worst times of your life and you're so desperate to find your own child. And then you put some of that effort and concern into others. I mean, just says so much about his character. He even offered money from Brian's reward fund to hold rallies with parents and families of other missing people. So truly an amazing guy. But meanwhile, of course, he kept searching for Brian no matter what. And he even ended up contacting a psychic, which is, you know, very controversial in true crime. But the psychic told him that Brian's body was in the Olentangy River under the Fifth Avenue Bridge, stuck in a whirlpool.
Very specific.
Yeah. So Randy and his brother, Brian's uncle Kevin, ended up wearing fishing waders and searched the muddy river for hours on their own. And Randy actually slipped into the whirlpool at one point, and Kevin had to pull him out of it. Just terrible. And Kevin said of this experience, quote, "This father shouldn't be going through all of this. Please let him find his son."
Oh, God, I can just see them out there. It's just
horrific.
Just be horrible.
It really would be. I can't think of anything that would be much worse than that.
But I don't really blame people for contacting psychics. Like, if you're at the end, exhausted all leads and there's nowhere else to turn, I mean, why not?
Yeah.
You never know.
Yep.
There's actually documented cases where psychics have actually solved.
Yeah, I always bring
and
that
help
to
find
people.
The FBI has even used psychics.
If I were Randy and this psychic told me there's a whirlpool underneath the Fifth Avenue Bridge in the Olentangy River, and then I go there and there's a whirlpool underneath the Fifth Avenue Bridge, I'm kind of thinking like, oh shit, this person's onto something. So, you know, like, it's close enough to where, like, I'd think it would be credible, honestly, if I were in Randy's shoes. I 100% would be think it's credible.
When you're in that desperate of a position, I absolutely would turn to any possible lead, you know, even if it's coming from, because, yeah, there's plenty of examples. Just last week, I covered one that was terrible, a psychic that just was horrible to this family. But, yeah, I mean, why not? Right. So then on August 22nd, 2006, police released a photo of a person of interest in Brian's disappearance. And the person came forward the following day. However, the police ruled them out after questioning them. And we cannot find the photo or the name of this person. And we're unsure why the police thought they were connected in the first place. So that's a big question mark, unfortunately.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Alexis had called Brian's phone every night since he disappeared. And for her, it really became sort of a ritual. Even though his phone didn't ring, she liked hearing his voice through his voicemail message. But then on September 8th, 2006, she called Brian's phone and something new happened. It rang three times before going to voicemail as if it were turned on. So she was like, whoa, this is a really good sign. So she immediately contacted the police and they were able to trace the ping to a cell tower in the nearby town of Hilliard. However, the wireless company, which I think was Singular, explained that this was a simple glitch. Sometimes when a cell tower gets too busy, it will bump the call to the closest one. And while the phone connects to the new tower, you'll hear it ring until it connects. It can't be confirmed as Brian's phone didn't have GPS, so they could never track an exact location. Still, this does seem to be the most likely explanation. Yeah, a lot of people definitely are skeptical of this explanation from the wireless company, but kind of makes sense to me.
Also, one thing to note, again, people online are saying that during the time that the cell phone pinged, Clint was actually house-sitting for a professor in Hilliard. Which has made people speculate, like, if maybe Clint had possession of Brian's phone during the time that it had pinged. However, the house that Clint was watching was on High Street in downtown Columbus, about 20 minutes away from Hilliard. So, again, not really anything of, you know, it's kind of like grasping for straws at that point.
But one cool thing that happened is that Pearl Jam visited Columbus on May 22nd, 2006, and Brian even had tickets for this tour. And Alexis auctioned them off for the reward fund. But Eddie Vedder, the lead singer, even spoke about Brian's disappearance to the crowd, and he did it again when the band returned to Columbus in 2010.
I think that is so cool. Eddie Vedder is one of the coolest guys to ever walk the planet, in my opinion.
Wow.
I love him.
High regards for Eddie Vedder.
I love Eddie Vedder.
Doesn't he have the that really iconic voice, Eddie Vedder.
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty iconic. Yeah.
What's one of their songs?
I play Eddie Vedder. I'm not into Pearl Jam as much as I'm into like his.
Does anybody know a Pearl Jam song that we know?
I was like, fucking, like, Terrell baby, or some shit like that. I will say,
Terrell baby,
something like that.
My mom's sitting over here. She would probably know. No? Come on, Mom. You know a Pearl Jam song. You've got to know one.
Why are you the way that you are?
Well, the one you hear me play all the time, one of my favorite songs, is Guaranteed by Eddie Vedder, but it's not a Pearl Jam song.
I know he did do this like ukulele songs album that was a very like 2010 Starbucks core that I was really into in middle school. I was really into it in middle school.
Hell yeah. But I mean, what a stand-up person to take the time to mention someone not only once, but twice. That's just huge. And he's a really good dude.
So as time passed and more searches focused on the Olentangy River, a few detectives developed a new theory. New York City detectives Kevin Gannon and Anthony Duarte had been linking the deaths of 45 young men who had been found dead near a body of water to a potential serial killer or a gang of serial killers. Most of these deaths have been attributed to accidental drowning after a night out drinking, but these detectives alleged it was part of a larger plot dating back to the late 90s. The theory links the deaths to one another due to how the victim died, as well as a graffiti of smiley faces near where the body was found. And there's a little bit of like controversy around even that part of the smiley face killer theories. Like the smiley faces are found near where the body enters the water.
Yeah. Right.
Versus where the body's found is kind of confusing. I mean, there's a lot of very confusing elements to the smiley face killer theory, and that's exactly what it is. I actually just covered the smiley face killer theory on Lights Out, good 3 hours worth, going over.
It's a big one.
Yeah, yeah. And I can see why this gets mentioned in this case, because he was relatively close to the river. He could have kept walking to the river, you know, if he was drunk and, you know, walking along it, he could have slipped and fell in. But then again, we would have found him at some point.
Right.
Right. Unless, you know, unless he is at the bottom of the river somewhere.
No, even then.
But by now, somebody, we would have found some trace of him.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Riley Strain, that case that is pretty recent. We haven't covered it, but.
We talked about it.
Oh, did you?
We did.
I was going
to
say.
Yeah, we definitely had to mention the Riley Strain case. And even that one is pretty clear as an accidental.
Yeah.
And that's the difficult thing with it is there's absolutely drugging going on in a lot of these deaths that are being connected to the smiley face killer because of GHB, you know, a drug that's used to... You know,
it's a date rape drug. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but Roofy. Even then, there's a lot of just cases where GHB is not found or very minimal traces and your body actually produces GHB in low levels. And that's the hard thing with it is these detectives would be like, oh, every single one of these people had GHB in their systems, but they never mentioned the levels of GHB because there's going to be low amounts of GHB just based on your body, body chemistry. So this one to me, there's no connection, no relation to smiley face killer theory or murders because it'd be the only victim that's never been found, which would be very different from all the other cases. And we have no evidence that he actually went to the river, let alone fell in. Something worth bringing up, I think, because a lot of people, anytime somebody with, you know, who's young, college age male, you know, successful, because it's like all the victims in the smiley face killers, they all have, it's all the same demographic, basically. They're all, you know, college age, they're all successful for the most part, they're all well-liked, and, you know, it's kind of created this, it's really a mythos at this point, it seems like, with the smiley face killers. It's just this creepy mythos that's been created. And even the detectives, Kevin Gannon and Anthony Duarte, have kind of like removed themselves a bit from being connected to smiley face killers, and they're more focused on the all of these drowning deaths that have been ruled accidental. They're interested in figuring out, are some of these accidental deaths actually homicides? Because there's definitely a few, and a few that we cover in our episode, that seemed to be homicides, and they were ruled accidental drownings by police. So it's very interesting, but that's a whole other can of worms to get into, but definitely worth mentioning in this one at least.
I also think like any sort of suspicion that he ended up in the river is like you said, it's been so long now. And the Olentangy, it's not like the Mississippi. Like, it doesn't get very deep. Randy was able to, like, walk around it in fishing waders. And yes, he got pulled into the whirlpool, but still, like, Brian was 6'2". At some point, he probably would have washed up onto a shallower side.
Yeah.
If that's where he ended up.
And it has been searched pretty extensively.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I feel like if he went in there, they would have found him by this point, or some sign of him at the very least. Then on September 14, 2008, the Schaefer family experienced another tragedy. The remnants of Hurricane Ike hit central Ohio with 70 mile per hour winds. Randy had entered his front yard to either clear debris or possibly refill his power generator when suddenly the winds tore down a massive tree branch, which ended up striking Randy in the neck, killing him. And
Horrific. His
body was discovered the next day by a neighbor, which just... I mean, talk about freak accident. I mean, it's just
horrible.
Crazy.
This family has been through so much. I mean, Derek's the only one left.
I know.
Lost his mom to cancer. His brother's missing. And then his dad. What a freak accident.
Yeah.
It's so horrible.
Really feel for him. That's just horrible. It's just so hard.
Yeah.
But Randy Schaefer was buried at the Maple Grove Cemetery on September 19, 2008. His online obituary allowed for comments posted by anyone who read it, presumably close friends and family. And 2 days before Randy's burial, a public comment was posted to his obituary that said, quote, "Dad, I love you." And it was signed Brian-Virgin Islands. Strange, right? But people do all sorts of strange things, especially with highly publicized cases. Yeah. And so.
Well, if it was really Brian, you think he would put Virgin Islands on there? You know, it's just obvious.
Right. If you're going to escape. Or you're going to go off and like start a new life somewhere, or you're going to put your location there.
It's very clearly a
cruel
so
hoax.
Mean.
Yeah, a cruel prank or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
But police still looked into it, and they quickly determined that the post was from a library computer in Franklin County, Ohio, not in the Virgin Islands. Since there was no way to track the individual user of the computer because it's a public computer, police determined it to be a hoax.
Just some fucking loser.
As for Alexis, she was able to balance her life after Brian's disappearance. After about a year, she stopped calling him every night, and she ended up finishing med school, and she met Eric Noss, whom she ended up marrying in 2009, and she now lives happily married with Eric and her two boys and practices as an OBGYN in Toledo. But not a single credible lead was found in Brian Schaefer's disappearance for over 10 years. In 2018, the Ugly Tuna Saluna in the Gateway closed down. Some hope new evidence could be found behind their equipment as the bar cleared out. Unfortunately, nothing was found. A student newspaper article about the closing said, quote, "An Ohio State medical student went missing from Ugly Tuna in 2006 without a trace. Google the story. It's actually really unsettling. I know that no establishment that serves alcohol to college students is completely safe, but the Ugly Tuna always gave me extra creepy vibes." I wonder what they mean by that. Of course, the Ugly Tuna 2 opened only a year later in the downtown bar district. Then in 2020, a photo of a homeless man in Tijuana, Mexico was sent to the FBI because somebody said that he looked a lot like Brian.
I see what they mean, though.
Yeah.
It does look a lot like Brian.
They wanted the FBI to take a look. The man had been seen in San Diego months before the photo was taken, and it matched the description of a place Brian would want to run off to, aka sandy beaches, lots of sunny days down there in Baja. However, a few days later, the FBI determined that the man was not Brian through facial recognition analysis, which, I mean, I'm sure the FBI has got some great software. But yeah, I mean, I can see why people think he looks like Brian a little bit.
Especially when you look at the age-progressed photo of him.
Yeah, which came out on March 29th, 2021. Mm-hmm. And this shows what Brian might look like at age 42.
Like, if you throw a beard on the photo of this guy, it would look a lot like the guy in Tijuana.
Yep. Yeah, even, I don't know, his nose is pretty different, though. Yeah.
I wonder why the FBI didn't at least go check this guy out and talk to him.
Well, they may have. Who knows?
Well, they just said that they use facial recognition software
on the
photo. So we don't know. I guess they could have and just not told anybody.
Right.
But why not at least be like, hey, we went and checked you know, interview this guy, talk to him, and
well, it's probably
confirm.
Hard to track him down too. It's a lot of resources.
Oh, the FBI yeah. can track down anybody.
That is true, Josh.
Or employ the help of the federales. I think that's how you say it. The Mexican police. Just trying to pronounce it. It's probably butchered that one.
Yeah, maybe.
Federales.
We'll let the audience be the judge on that.
Dog. But this is the last official lead into the disappearance of Brian Schaefer, which is crazy to think in this age of technology and
yep.
everything is tracked pretty much that he's just gone. There's just no trace.
Mm-hmm.
And now more than 18 years later, we are all left with just rumors and theories about what could have happened to him that night.
So let's jump into some of those rumors and theories, starting with the rumors. Now, it's important to note off the top that the following claims are unsubstantiated. Dozens of online communities are, like we said, super committed to uncovering new information about Brian's disappearance. Some claim that they've gathered this information through FOIA requests or ties to the family. But regardless, take most of these rumors that we're going to talk about with a grain of salt, a large grain of salt, I would say. But they're all we have to go off of, with there being no new information, no leads, no nothing. So according to some, Brian wasn't only dealing with academic stress and grief, obviously, from the passing of his mother, but he also had financial troubles as well. Rumors, not confirmed. But aside from the credit card debt that most college students rack up, his dad was apparently about to cut him off financially. This rumor states that when Randy gave Brian his tuition check at the beginning of March, he told him that this would be the last time he would financially support him. His mother, Renee, was extremely sick at the time, and they both knew that Brian was going to receive $20,000 when she passed. And according to this rumor, Randy cut off Brian in preparation for the will payment. This could explain why Brian never cashed the check or paid Ohio State with it. Perhaps he was saving it, you know, for a rainy day or waiting until he secured the will payment before giving the check to the school. Some claim that he had planned to use this check to pay for his getaway, but could no longer cash it after Randy closed his accounts following his disappearance, which I think is really interesting that he did that. Why do you think he would close the accounts?
I mean, I'm still just trying to wrap my head around why they would be cutting him off.
Well, we don't know, so I feel like there's not.
You know what I mean? He was doing everything that he was supposed to be doing and going to school.
Well, maybe it was like a, you know, preparing him for the real world type situation. But we don't know if it even is true. So I feel like it's not even worth trying to figure it out. But why? We know for a fact that his accounts were closed. Why was that?
From at least what I can tell from the interviews Randy did, part of the reason he did that was because he was worried, like, oh, Brian's missing. Say the worst happened and he was, or not even the worst, say he was just separated from his wallet and some stranger found it and just started using his cards. I think it was purely for like a financial security reason.
Totally.
I will say on the, there's an even less substantiated rumor that Randy was actually getting cut out of the will, out of Renee's will, because he, you know, he and her had grown apart or something. I don't think that's true in the slightest.
Yeah, it doesn't.
And so, but that's why some people were like, oh, he was jealous of Brian getting all this money. And it's just bullshit. No. It's complete bullshit.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most plausible reason.
Yeah.
Just out of pure security concerns.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want the check to fall into the wrong hands and get cashed or something. So you might as well just cancel the check, cancel the account so that you don't have to worry about it.
And then obviously there's lots of rumors around Brian's relationship with Clint. As you know, Clint was the last person we know of that saw Brian before he disappeared. The two of them had been roommates and then ended their lease early for unknown reasons, as we talked about. And they also routinely fought, though the reasons for those fights, like we said, were never officially released. But some people claim that Brian was a serial cheater and that the fights often came from Clint calling out Brian for his infidelity. Some said that Brian and his high school girlfriend would still hook up whenever she returned to Ohio. While it's unclear if this happened when Brian was with Alexis, it likely occurred while he lived with Clint, if it is true. This could have been the reason for their early split. But again, we have no idea. So I don't feel like it's helpful to read too much into that either. And while we don't know why they fought specifically on St. Patty's Day, They likely fought the night that Brian disappeared because he flirted with those two undergrads. That's kind of the general belief. But again, no one really knows. According to one statement, he kissed one of their necks while flirting, and it's confirmed that he did give them his number and offered to walk them to their car. So that adds a little more validity to that rumor. But could Clint have, you know, called Brian out for flirting with these two girls days before his trip to Miami with Alexis? Possibly. It's also important to note that Clint's statements about Brian's way with women are what led his family to point fingers at him, which is ultimately why Clint, you know, lawyered up. And while we understand why his family would want to defend Brian's character, discussing these rumors is important because they're really integral to these theories. If these rumors are even true, Brian's infidelity certainly doesn't make him a bad person. We want to make it clear. It just means that he made mistakes during a very stressful period of his life, and we just don't know if it even happened.
And there's hundreds of theories about Brian's disappearance at this point. I mean, mainly stem from a lack of evidence, overall notoriety in the case, and the belief that the police just missed something important. So we've tried to compile the most credible, but again, still, these are completely unconfirmed. One of the reigning online theories came from a now-deleted user who continually blamed two Ohio brothers for Brian's disappearance and other Ohio area cold cases. After a while, the user was seen as just a nut job, and the two brothers sued her for defamation. And again, all that is to say, please take these with a grain of salt. So let's talk about one. Let's get one out of the way, because I think it's definitely something worth mentioning, but likely the probably the most unlikely one. So is it possible Brian snuck away to take his own life? He hadn't slept much the previous week and was described as, quote, anxious to go out that night by Randy. Maybe the pressures of school, the pressure of proposing to Alexis, or even just being overwhelmed with grief after the death of his mom was a lot for him to handle. But again, this is still very unlikely because no one close to Brian described him as suicidal. On top of that, there would likely be some type of trace depending on how he did it. Because again, it's impossible to hide yourself after you take your own life. So, you know, back to the river. Some have pointed to the Olentangy River, which was only half a mile from the Ugly Tuna. Could he have gone there, slipped in? Sometimes people will, you know, just go explore when you're, you know, when you're feeling good, you know, you're buzzing. Sometimes you just want to go by the water and you're, you know, your judgment's off, you're impaired, you know, you're wobbly. It's very possible. Could have just slipped in, you know, the current takes you and maybe it takes you far, far down the river before anybody can find you. Again, the river was searched. He would have likely washed up on the banks at some point, and that's never happened. So seems pretty unlikely to me. But let's talk about foul play, because I think we're probably all thinking this is the most likely scenario.
I'm not, but...
Okay. Is it possible that after he left the Ugly Tuna, however way he did that, which to me, it seems like the only way possible, unless he just was unrecognizable on security footage for some way, shape, or form, seems like when the band left and there was that group of people that left with them through the service exit, is it possible he was just kind of clustered in the group and just went out with them? Because again, he did go talk to the band, or said he was going to go talk to the band, and he was also interested in an after party. So I think of a band, you know, shutting down for the evening and a group of people following them, that leads me to believe there was something else happening after, you know, the show that night. Were they going to go party somewhere? Were they, you know, I don't know if they had a bus or, you know, something outside, a vehicle or something that they all piled into and went somewhere else. It seems like he went out that way. But if he just left with them and then headed home from there, could he have been a victim to, you know, just an opportunistic criminal of some sort? It's possible.
Yeah, definitely possible. I'd say that's my second place theory.
Because again, you know, after leaving that area, there's just a dirt alleyway. There's, you know, it's not being monitored. So could have just been wrong place, wrong time. Somebody mugged him and then murdered him and then possibly hit him in a dumpster or something.
Well, we see it all the time in college towns at these types of bars
And, you know, people are waiting for, you know, people who are vulnerable to take advantage of.
Yeah, and true.
That absolutely could have happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about it a number of times on the show.
Definitely.
People are literally watching these types of places mm-hmm. to look for victims.
Yeah.
So I think that's a real theory. And possibly he was thrown into a dumpster and then the dumpster was taken away or emptied before police could actually get over there and start searching mm-hmm. Is another possibility.
Like this for me is my most likely. Some of the businesses, you know, do trash pickup every day, and a lot of them would have had their trash picked up on Sunday. However, you know, just to play devil's advocate a little bit, if I were, I mean, I wouldn't be an opportunistic mugger, but if I saw Brian, you know, again, a 6'2", highly athletic guy, no matter how drunk he is, I don't know if he would be my target. You
right.
know?
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's a great point.
He's a big guy. You know, I don't know. Like, even if I had a weapon, I feel like that would not be my choice.
Yeah.
Well, and just looking at pure statistics, it's females that mm-hmm. are being preyed upon,
yeah.
right? From all these other cases that we've covered, yeah. it's always they're singling out the girls that are walking home alone or, you know, something along those lines. So I agree with you. I think that to me doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Like, would he be the prime target unless this was an organized mm-hmm. situation? It wasn't a crime of opportunity, but yet somebody was waiting for him once he left and met him full well knowing that they're now out of range of cameras and then did something to him possibly. Which the whole dumpster theory of him being dumped in a dumpster and then the dumpster being picked up could also possibly explain the phone ping in Hilliard months later. Again, most likely a glitch, but if it wasn't, the cell tower was near a recycling plant, so maybe all those months later the phone made its way to the plant and was accidentally turned on during the sorting process, and that's why it pinged. But Hilliard also brings up the two girls Brian flirted with, as one of them actually lived in Hilliard. Maybe Brian did walk them to their car after all. Again, the service entrances were well known by OSU students who snuck around the Gateway complex. Maybe Brian met them through the exit after speaking with the band and then returned to Hilliard with them. But again, that would insinuate they would somehow know, you know, what happened to him, or at least have some further events in the timeline to report. So it doesn't seem likely that the girls were involved in any foul play if that did occur. But and also they were highly cooperative with the police and likely didn't know what happened to him. Still, at least one of the girls had a boyfriend then, and maybe they would have kept the information hidden about Brian returning home with them possibly. But still, I feel like with something this big and after yeah. all these years, like mm-hmm. why wouldn't you just come forward if you were like, oh yeah, actually Brian did come back with me to right. my house. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you never know. I mean, people just sometimes don't want to be involved.
And then I think you could also go back to the little surveillance footage we have of Brian where it kind of shows him reaching his arm around to the girls. Again, some speculate he possibly put his phone in their purse or put something in their purse. But I think when you rewatch it over and over again, the more you do, it kind of just seems like he was just like reaching out to like
yeah.
touch them or like kind of side hug them a little bit. And then,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it's really hard to say.
I think like, you know, any of the theories that come from the CCTV stuff in general is like pretty bullshit. Like, it's interesting to watch for sure, but like even as we were recording, like Tom literally sent me a new theory from being like, oh, this guy in the CCTV footage is really suspicious and he probably drugged Brian. And when you watch it, he's just standing there with like another group of people.
That was Tom's theory?
No, Tom just sent me like a new one he found
on Reddit.
He
literally just sent it to us?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it's just like,
which if you didn't know, Tom is our editor for the show.
Shouts out Tom. But it's, I just feel like any of the theories, like it's still good to watch the CCTV just to like understand his demeanor at the mm-hmm. time.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see like, oh, did he put something in a purse? Da, da, da. Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. You could go any which yeah, way exactly. with that footage. And
yeah.
there's literally no way to be sure.
Well, here is a entirely batshit theory. He died in the bar and then was hidden in the walls or hidden in the band's equipment case. And surprisingly, this theory has like a lot of traction.
Too much. Of course it does. The internet loves the most outlandish.
Well, this is like the ultimate conspiracy.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're just kind of getting that
the ugly tuna saloon is covering up a death that occurred in their restaurant.
And they hit him in the walls, or the band was involved and they put him in their equipment. Come on, people. It's crazy. But yeah, we just have to address it because there's going to be comments. I mean, that it's talked about a lot, surprisingly.
Well, again, because it goes back to we never saw Brian leave. So is it possible he's still there? He never did leave that place.
Plus, the police did bring cadaver dogs through the building on multiple occasions.
If there was a deceased body in there, cadaver dogs would be able to smell it.
And I mean, I understand why people are sketched out by the ugly tuna. I mean, it's just
sketchy college bars. They're all sketchy. Yeah. Let's be honest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But and they were highly cooperative during the investigation. Highly.
Well, yeah, because they want the police off their back, man.
Yeah,
they're gonna try to give them what they want so that they can move on.
But it's like you have to ask yourself at the end of the day, why would the band or the bar have
just make things way worse for them?
And why would they just, what would they have? What reason? There is no reason.
Well, I think the idea is that perhaps he died of alcoholic consumption or something, or maybe he was slipped something. Maybe he took something and he died on the premises. But again, that's why these businesses have insurance. You know what I mean? Like there's liability insurance for a reason.
Yeah,
they're not going to be like, oh shit, we need to cover this up because this guy died on. No, that'd be
and
the worst thing you could do.
People would know.
Yeah.
People, it's not like he would just die and only someone in the band or someone at the bar sees it and they secretly do. I mean,
right.
Come on.
Well, and how many people would be in this conspiracy? And really?
Plus, he's 6'2", where they're going to hide him in their equipment, like dig a hole into the wall.
Yeah, I don't think there's even an instrument with a case big enough to put a 6'2" human inside.
There are some theories that I guess have a little bit more credibility to them, hold a little bit more water about him having been hidden inside of the gateway still. Some people have noted that there were new elevator shafts that would have been filled with concrete the following morning, and Brian would have been in this location if he had gone through the service exit, and in his drunk state, could he have tripped into one of the elevator shaft holes and knocked himself out before they poured concrete over the site? Again, still pretty unlikely. I mean, Brian was pretty big, and I mean, the holes are large too, but they were only 4 feet deep and a little over 6 foot wide. So they likely would have noticed him unless the construction workers just didn't even look and just poured in the concrete.
This is like entering like movie show territory, like Hollywood. This is just like, has it happened before? Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, this hole doesn't seem very deep. And when the people pour concrete, they need to look where they're pouring to make sure that it's actually being poured evenly. That's the whole point of concrete, is it's got to be poured perfectly. So
I guess you can't like totally rule it out.
Yeah, it could just be the most crazy thing that's ever happened, and that day somebody wasn't watching while they poured concrete and they poured it. But even then, I feel like I don't know how good of a pour that would be. Like the concrete could crack over time, and I don't know.
Could they
doesn't
use
make a whole lot
like
of sense.
Sonar type equipment to detect
I believe there is equipment that can do that.
There is. I don't know.
It works over concrete, but.
Other people have also pointed to the movie theater and how the ceiling panels could have been, you know, easily accessible, could have been moved. Maybe he could have gone up there and suffocated up there. But again, highly unlikely. Why would he be doing this?
Which I must say, and I think why people do go this far is because I can't help but think of the Elisa Lam case.
Where
she's in the water tank on top of the hotel. Like that case is so wild and makes zero sense on how she ended up there that I think, I mean, there's endless theories on that as well. But I think when things like that happen, that's why there's such wild speculation, because crazier things have happened, you know?
And I think it's just trying to fill the gaps of something that doesn't make sense and has such little information. But yeah, just keep in mind, cadaver dogs have cased the entire Gateway building. And even if Brian was in a spot that was untouched by eventual renovation, the dogs likely would have smelled him. There's also a theory that Brian left with the band's large entourage through the service exit. When they got to the Wendy's parking lot, maybe they did hard drugs and Brian overdosed. According to this theory, it would have been the band who hid his body. Possible. I think we all agree here that's probably pretty unlikely. I mean, he was public about liking weed, but wasn't known to ingest hard drugs. Even Clint, who has been, you know, one of the most honest and upfront about his view of Brian's lifestyle, he never brought up hard drugs. And if, even if he just did it that night on a whim, why would the band incriminate themselves by hiding his body? I mean, it just, I don't know. Again, possible. I don't know. I don't think so.
There's no evidence, but a possibility. Then there's also the potential that Clint knows more than he does, or that he said, which I think there's some truth to that, because he refused to take the lie detector test. He did lawyer up early on. This could just mean that he has said more and the police have just not released that information, which I think is highly probable.
Yeah.
I do feel like the police have more information on this case than what is available publicly, and there's a reason for that. But again, I think after all these years, you know, if Clint was involved, there would have been more that would have come out. You know, they had every inkling and every reason to investigate him thoroughly. And so I'd assume that that's been done. And if he hasn't ever been named a suspect or anything like that, I think, you know, there's probably not any more to that. Again, maybe he's hiding something possibly, but there's just really nothing there. So I'm not going to dwell on that too much. But that leads us to, I think, the theory you, Kendall, think is the most probable.
Yeah.
Or is possible.
I guess
possible.
It's just, I hope that this is the case. But obviously, the theory is that Brian is still out there, that he left on his own accord. And I think there's several reasons to think that. You know, he was known to disappear sometimes while drinking. He took that random trip to the Caribbean just out of nowhere. And, you know, I keep going back to him asking Alexis, would you run away with me and leave everything behind? And then there's the, I want to go off to an island one day. And
yeah.
The doctor thing is just a job for now. And I don't know, part of me thinks it'd be very horrible to leave his dad in that situation, especially to tell him he was going to come the next day. But it's kind of interesting that he made time to go to dinner with him. I've thought maybe that was to see him one last time. Or it's possible that he's always had the idea of running away in the back of his head. I think for him to have actually voiced that to his girlfriend, and it was serious enough that she brought it up to law enforcement, that he has said this to me. You know, if that was a casual thing, why would you even bring that up? So in my mind, I think, is it possible that he has had this idea in the back of his head? And that maybe he wasn't planning to do it that night, but something happened that we're not aware of, or maybe he did have, like, was kind of, you know, was, why am I forgetting the name? Like, cheated that night.
Yeah, like maybe he did end up going home with these girls and hooked up with them, then felt shame afterwards because he's like,
hugely regretful. He's supposed to propose to his girlfriend
right.
the following.
I just fucked up this whole relationship right. that I had, this great thing I had going for me.
Is it possible that he didn't have the plan all ironed out, but went somewhere else for the meantime and then made a plan and left? And it sounds hard to believe that in today's day and age that people can purposely disappear, but it happens. It's very hard to do, very hard to do. So obviously I'm considering that. It could be unlikely, but I don't know. I just, part of me feels that that is just the most likely scenario. And again, it's probably just wishful thinking that I hope he's alive and out there and sipping margaritas on a beach somewhere.
Well, is it possible too, the reason why there's been no new leads in this case is because he eventually contacted police and told them that, hey,
well,
I'm still alive?
That could be, but actually, no, it can't, because they did declare him legally dead. His family asked for him to be declared dead, and the police cannot do that if they know that he's alive. So, yeah, we know that he hasn't gotten in contact with law enforcement or anything like that. But I don't know, maybe he really is out there. And why would he come back with how tragic his whole family ended up? And I don't know. It's horrible. It's horrible to think that you could actually do something like that. It's, I think, hard to wrap your mind around just running away from your life.
Yeah, what if
you don't
family
know
member
what's going
did that?
On in your mind?
Yeah.
I'd be devastated, obviously, but I think some people have this. It seemed like Brian had a lot of thoughts about not living the way that he wanted to and having these dreams of being, you know what I mean? I could see it.
I totally see it. Again, it's what I wish happened too. You know, there have definitely been points in my life, especially after drinking, frankly, where yeah. I'm like, fuck it. Like, I'm just going to go somewhere. And, mm-hmm. you know, I used to disappear while I was out with my friends too.
Really?
And I mean, I wouldn't, you know, book a plane ticket or something, but
yeah.
I would just go walk alone for a very long time. And I think, I don't know, I definitely could see it. The more practical side of me does lean to foul play or like slept in a dumpster and it got taken out or something. Cause I mm-hmm. also have done that in my, not slept in a dumpster, oh. slept near a dumpster. I don't know. I do think there's something to just like, he got up and left and mm-hmm. you know, this is, we just don't know where he is. And I truly hope that's what happened, honestly.
I do too. And I go back to him losing his mom and like how, I mean, they were so, so close. And maybe he was just in such a dark place that he just needed to get away from everything and everybody and start over.
Well, maybe his life at school and medical school and stuff just reminded him too much of his mom.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just
too
hard on him emotionally. And he's just like, you know what? I need to just start over.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've lost almost everybody I care about in my life, of course, and other than his brother, obviously. And that to me, I'm like, I'd be really curious to hear what his brother thinks.
Me too.
About this, because I wonder if he, I'm sure he has much more insight on it. I do think one other possibility when thinking back to the homeless man that was spotted in Tijuana is it possible that that night he left the Ugly Tuna and on his way home, he suffered some type of injury in some way, whether he was hit by somebody or he just fell and smacked his head on something and suffers from amnesia. Because we've seen that before where people...
But wouldn't he have been around that area still if he, you know...
Not like necessarily.
How far could he, yeah, I guess you're right. I don't know.
I always go back to the dude that was in New York and ended up on California in a matter of days and in the back of a semi. So I'm just saying like strange things happen when... Mm-hmm. People have head injuries and, you know, couple that with being intoxicated or consuming alcohol. I mean, you never know. Like, if we're going to talk about all the wild theories, amnesia seems more realistic to me than him still being in the Ugly Tuna
or
in the Gateway
that.
Complex. To me, I'm like, that's just like insane to even consider. But I think amnesia is one that doesn't often get considered because it seems to be a rare thing that happens. But I think it does happen. And... you know, some people out there who are missing could be suffering from amnesia, don't remember who they are, don't know their identity, don't know anything about them. And obviously, as time goes on, their appearance changes and they're unrecognizable. Mm-hmm. So that's just another possibility. But again, I think when looking at all the circumstances, how everything played out, it does seem, you know, a victim of a crime, an opportunistic crime that occurred the night after he left, somebody mugged him or something like that. And dumped his body somewhere. But I also think it's very possible he left to start over and just kind of get away from his life.
It's like you have to think about there very well could be other things that we don't know about that happened in his life or around this time that he didn't want anyone to know about or things he was feeling or, you know, had contact with someone somewhere else. You just never know. And I think it's interesting that there's so much made out of the idea that he was like forced into medical school. It seemed like his mom like encouraged it. We don't know the extent of that, so you can't really read too much into that. But yeah, I don't know. It seems like he wasn't doing what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
He said that. So.
And everybody deals with grief differently.
Yep.
So sometimes people, especially when you experience that kind of grief, maybe you just come to the realization that I need to get out. I need to go. Because like one thing that comes to my mind is when you lose people almost back to back like that, the thing you start thinking about, I'm sure gets amplified when you're drinking, is life is short.
Yeah.
Life is short.
Yes.
That's every such day a great... is not guaranteed. So you know what? I'm not going to live my life the way that I feel everybody else wants me to live or the world wants me to live. I'm going to go follow my true passion and I'm going to go do just that.
Yeah. And maybe he just felt the people in his life just wouldn't understand or would try to convince him otherwise and he didn't want to deal with it. And
yeah. Cause I mean, it has, you know, there is rumors and reports out there that he's allegedly been spotted traveling from Indiana to Sweden and Mexico. So there's alleged sightings out there, nothing confirmed by any means. So you just never know. It's a big world and yeah, you just never know where people might be. But if you do have any information regarding the disappearance of Brian Schaefer, the Columbus Police Department is still working his case and you can reach them at 614-645-2358. But yeah, I mean, this one is just truly a mystery.
I really, really hope he's out there sipping those margs on the beach somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too.
I feel so badly for his brother, Derek. It's just horrendous. Just
really, really rough, man.
And I hope that wherever his dad's soul is, you know, that he has the answers.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
it's
true.
It's so tough. God, really, really tragic.
Yeah.
Tragic story of this family. But yeah, we want to hear what you guys think. Let us know what theory makes most sense to you, or maybe you have a theory that we didn't bring up. Let us know your thoughts in the comments below, or you can head over to our Instagram account, at Mile Higher Pod. Maybe we should make a MySpace account.
Yeah, to the five people that
isn't MySpace still like around though?
I think it's like mostly a music site now. Mm. I don't know. I don't think it's like the same social media platform.
I think they tried to rebrand and it
flopped.
Yeah, not do so great. So, but hey, you know, we can try it.
Shucky darns for Justin Timberlake, I guess.
Well, he's got bigger worries these days. So,
yeah, dude's having a bad time right now.
Yeah, yeah.
The world tour. Anyway, yeah, we definitely want to hear from you. So let us know on our social media or the comments below. But that is going to be it for us this week. We will be back next week. But until then,
keep on taking your mind a mile higher.
Well, that was so in sync.
Beautiful.